It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, staffers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention were reportedly barred from using certain words in the organization's budget proposals. We'll talk to a Wisconsin public health expert about his reaction and how language can affect the CDC's work. First, Republicans are rushing to pass a tax bill and have it on President Trump's desk before Christmas. If it passes, it would be a big win for the Trump administration after a year in office. Republicans say the bill would slash taxes for businesses and individuals and promote economic growth. Democrats say it'll benefit the rich at the expense of the middle class. Colin Wilhelm is an economic policy reporter for Politico. Colin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We have this compromise deal between what the House passed and what the Senate passed. Does it seem likely at this point that this will end up on the president's desk?
This looks like it's on the glide path towards becoming law. Republicans have really rushed this process in a way that a lot of folks thought they wouldn't be able to achieve in terms of timeline. But they've managed to hit their schedule, and they overcame some last-minute drama last week to get everybody that they need on board in order to pass this and send it to President Trump.
What are the main changes here as they put together the Senate and the House plans?
So the Senate plan, this final text follows the Senate plan in terms of treatment of individual tax cuts, basically in the sense that those will expire in 2025 for the most part. That happened because they need to fit those tax cuts within a rigid budgetary rule structure in order to be able to pass this along party lines in the Senate. It's a similar process to how Obamacare was passed in 2010. Basically, if you use this budget parliamentary maneuver that they have chosen to use on this tax package, you can pass this without having to achieve the normal 60-vote threshold to avoid a filibuster.
Looking at a couple of the high-profile things, I want to ask you if certain things are still in or out. One big one people were watching for was the repeal of the mandate under the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. As I understand it, that was in the Senate plan. It is still in this compromise plan, right?
That's correct. That is repealed as of 2019. The individual mandate, which is basically a penalty for folks who don't purchase health insurance, basically to try to enforce the buy-in for Obamacare, or either getting covered for health insurance through your employer or to go out to the exchanges and purchase it.
And looking at some of the big points here, what happens to the corporate tax rate? That wasn't a huge controversy, I don't think, between the House and Senate plans, right?
No, they were largely in agreement on that, although they crept slightly above the red line that the president had laid out for a 20% corporate rate. So the current nominal rate is 35%. They slashed that to 21%, and the administration had tried to keep that at 20%, but ended up giving just a little bit in order to pay for some of the other provisions within this plan.
We are looking at the tax overhaul plan. There's a compromise between the House and Senate aiming to vote on it this week. Colin Wilhelm is with us, economic policy reporter for Politico. Colin, you mentioned that most of the individual tax cuts would expire because of that Senate rule. But what do we see change in individual taxes? I know it's a huge question. It depends on who you are.
Definitely depends on who you are. And disclaimer, I am not a CPA, but most folks listening to this will end up receiving a tax cut. It depends on what you might itemize. So basically the section of your tax return that says, you know, check this box if you did this over the course of the last year, maybe if you have a mortgage, maybe if you paid a lot in property taxes or have large medical expenses. But Republicans, by and large, at the onset of this, they made a lot of noise about simplifying the code and trying to do away with a lot of deductions in order to make this quote-unquote revenue neutral, meaning that it wouldn't add to the overall federal budget deficit. They sort of let that fall by the wayside over the course of this fall and gave themselves about $1.5 trillion to work with over the next 10 years. They basically said, look, this plan, we think it'll gin up the economy and basically pay for parts of itself through that but we're going to give ourselves some room to breathe on this front. They've received a lot of criticism over that from Democrats, that, you know, they're only deficit hawks when it's convenient for them. But in terms of that, let them basically not make some of the hard choices that they would have otherwise had to make on the individual side in particular. And so a lot of those deductions might get reduced. For example, the mortgage interest deduction is reduced from a $1 million cap to a $750,000 cap on new mortgages. But basically, they were kind of able to have dessert without eating a lot of their vegetables.
Now, this all came down to a few senators, or it all does come down to a few senators, as we saw with the Affordable Care Act repeal and replace effort. It takes just, what, three Republican senators not voting for this. I want to look at a couple of the holdouts who are now in, apparently, Senator Bob Corker, one of them. And his big objection, as I understand it, was deficit. This thing's going to increase the deficit. Did anything change when it comes to the deficit and the tax overhaul plan?
No, and that was the real shock, that he switched his vote, given his previous concerns over that. There is really no major change as to how this plan approaches the deficit. In fact, the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is a neutral government-run analysis, basically think tank within the government for tax policy, said this is going to lose about $1.4 trillion over the next 10 years due to the loss in revenue for the federal government. So there's no major difference. It was a little bit of a shock that he switched his vote on Friday. I've seen reports of some speculation about private interests of his. That's not really confirmed. There's also just maybe the basic reality that this had a lot of momentum behind it and was going to pass. When he had said that he was a no, he said he was a no reluctantly and basically wanted an excuse to get back onto supporting this tax bill. So he had this late change of heart, and it may have just come down to basic political momentum for Republicans making this happen.
And then Susan Collins of Maine, her concern was with the mandate cut. She's worried about subsidies for health care. And it sounds like she's negotiated something that, you know, to call a player to be named later, basically something that'll happen outside of the scope of this particular bill, right?
Yeah, that's a really good analogy, actually. Basically, she has cut a deal with Senate Republican leadership saying they will allow a vote and essentially have their members support subsidies to basically shore up the Obamacare's exchanges and try to prevent a premium spike when the individual mandate is repealed, basically over the fear that if fewer people are forced to buy health insurance, then insurance providers will raise the cost of health insurance to accommodate the fact that they're providing it to fewer people, that they basically have fewer customers. So she has organized that with Senate Republican leadership. She also cut a deal within the tax bill, a couple of deals within the tax bill, one notably also around health care. She got basically a drop in the threshold that people can claim the medical expense deduction for a couple of years, and then she preserved it long term, whereas in the House bill, it would have been repealed.
As we wrap up, can you talk about the political fallout? Assuming this does pass this week, Republicans will celebrate, I'm sure, a big achievement, but public opinion polls show that, as a lot of people understand it, this is viewed negatively by many in the public. So what happens after this passes?
Well, this is going to become a major campaign issue. In the midterm elections, Democrats have basically argued that this plan benefits corporations more than individuals because the corporate cuts are and benefits are permanent, whereas the individual ones are not. And as you mentioned, the public polling on this has not been particularly favorable. The Bush tax cuts that were passed, I saw a reference of the Gallup polling around that back when they were passed in the law, and they were more than 50% approval, a majority of Americans favored them, whereas this plan has been in the 20s and 30s, and Republicans are making a huge gamble here that public opinion of this is going to end up changing over the course of the next year because of economic effects, but there's a lot of extraneous factors that go into that too. And it's really going to be, an uphill climb for them to try to sway the public over the benefits of this plan.
Colin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Colin Wilhelm, economic policy reporter for Politico. He joined us to look at the tax bill Republicans are rushing to pass before Christmas. Right now, a new report from the Washington Post says that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention had presented a list of seven words not to include in documents related to the upcoming federal budget. On that list, vulnerable, entitlement, diversity, transgender, fetus, evidence-based, and science-based. The director of the CDC denies any such ban exists. Many people are concerned with the effect such a change could have on the agency's work. Dr. Patrick Remington is a professor and associate dean in the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He also serves on the CDC Task Force for Community Preventive Services and the CDC's Editorial Board for Preventing Chronic Disease. Dr. Remington, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what was your reaction when you heard these reports from some staffers at the CDC about these seven words being restricted, banned from the CDC's budget documents?
Well, I was really surprised, and I did a little bit of searching for the source of the news, and you have to be careful these days. Mm-hmm. When something comes out and it's a headline all of a sudden, you really want to know whether it's accurately citing what happened. And I think what happened is this is not words that have been explicitly banned from use by people at CDC, but the guidance was to those staff at CDC writing budget documents that if these seven words were avoided, that their budget proposals might fare better in the current Congress and administration.
Right. So this is not saying to a CDC researcher on the Zika virus, say, don't say the word fetus. We don't have any indication that that is happening.
No, again, this was budget. This was guidance for proposals going up the ladder to, from Atlanta up to Washington to be considered by the Trump administration. And again, the guidance was that these are words that might not fare as well given the current political environment as alternatives that may rather than saying, these are evidence-based programs. These are programs that have been shown to work and may be appropriate in communities depending on the situations in that community. So, in effect, soften the terminology. But again, at worst, it is an attempt to guide the a major science and evidence-based institution to do their work differently.
Does something like that, an attitude like that, potentially trickle down to people doing research in the field?
I think it will. I think any time you are threatened by avoiding terms that may not fare well the people who fund your programs, you not only avoid those words, but you may avoid the work. It's clearly been done in the area of firearm injury prevention research that those recommendations are fairly explicit that CDC is not to be involved in any research in that area. And so it can move from avoiding terms for political correctness all the way over to avoiding even examining these issues. And that, of course, would be horrible. I think the history of CDC is very interesting in that it's not in Washington, D.C. You might expect it to be as the nation's public health agency, but it was developed in Atlanta by accident, entirely by accident, following World War II.
Why did it end up in Atlanta? I've always been curious about it.
Well, it's a very interesting story in that when GIs returned from World War II, they brought malaria with them. And malaria, the insects that could transmit malaria were in the southern and eastern parts of the U.S. And to combat malaria in the U.S., they set up an organization called the Malaria Control in War Areas, the MCWA, in Atlanta to base these interventions to eradicate the mosquito and then malaria. And they did so successfully. And then the Emory University sold some property to the government for $10. And by 1946, that became the Communicable Disease Center, again, beginning with malaria control, but going on to other communicable diseases. And then in the 70s and 80s went on to many other diseases and became the Centers for Disease Control. But that very origin in Atlanta really has kept CDC fairly distant from the politics in Washington. It's been known as an agency that sets itself apart from the political winds of Washington and instead focusing on science and best evidence possible.
We're talking to Dr. Patrick Remington from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the reports that the CDC was going to be avoiding supposedly certain words in their budget presentations to the Trump administration. And Dr. Remington, can you talk about the role of the CDC, what it does? In the movies, you know, we see them in the hazmat suits when there's a huge disease breakout, but there's a lot more going on there.
Well, it certainly is. And one of the key aspects of the CDC is outbreak detection and control. And that's an extremely important part of the role of governmental public health. It was CDC at the lead and our state and local public health departments. But CDC plays a really important role in assessing the evidence and what we know might work in communities or in public health practice. In fact, I serve on a task force of unpaid volunteer scientists who go to CDC and who review the evidence to know whether these programs actually work. It's independent. It's not funded, not biased by industry or external groups. And the CDC is looked to as a source of that fair and unbiased scientific information. And so this is a concern that that this group, and in fact, I just got off a phone call with the task force moments ago where we're debating whether this guidance should change the work we do. And I wasn't able to stay on to hear the conclusion of the call, but my guess is going to be that we won't. We'll continue to make our recommendations based on the best evidence available.
Has the CDC been subject to political pressure from past administrations?
Absolutely. I think anytime you're involved in government, there is this friction between the folks at the front lines who are dealing with science and evidence and the people in the political settings who need to get elected and need to respond to their constituents. And probably the best known example of this was when HIV/AIDS was discovered during the Reagan administration and the reluctance of the administration at that time to first recognize that there was even an epidemic and then to support the investigations about its cause and strategies for interrupting the epidemic. And many times there are conflicts between what might be best evidence and then actually putting that evidence into practice in Washington and in states and local communities.
I want to look at a couple of the particular phrases that are apparently viewed as best avoided in CDC budget proposals. Science-based and evidence-based, why would those raise red flags, do you think?
Well, frankly, I don't know. I mean, I can understand some of the other words about issues related to diversity and sexual minorities, given the politics in Washington. But I'm perplexed as to why science-based and evidence-based would need to be avoided. The only thing I can think is that when a program is shown to be evidence-based, let's say raising the taxes on cigarettes is an evidence-based program to reduce the consumption of cigarettes, and many states have used this policy, that doesn't necessarily mean that a community should do that, that the decision to do that should go beyond the science and consider the politics and the economics and the social desirability. And it could be that if you want to get your budget proposal approved, don't rely simply on the fact that this is science and evidence-based. You need to put it into the context of the other factors in society. It's the only reason I could think that this guidance would have been given. And again, I think those two words really are chilling, to think that you have to avoid using the term science or evidence-based when making a budget proposal.
And then another one you just referenced there, transgender is one of the best avoided words according to this reporting.
The only thing I can think is that there are political factions that believe that this is something that is not desirable in society or in a federal budget, and again that a proposal that comes forward with that or the other words mentioned would be less likely to fare well. And I would imagine that the staff at CDC, that the leadership of CDC, in fact, the director of the CDC, Brenda Fitzgerald, has been tweeting that in no way will this change our work. We continue to use these terms in the work that we do. And so I suspect that this was a stumble by someone in the staff who was trying to, in effect, be helpful for to allow CDC to do its work, but to deal with the current political situations in Washington.
So as we wrap up, do you see this as maybe just a little bureaucratic glitch, not much to see there, or is this something that does have you worried?
It does have me worried. I think that it reflects the schism between science and politics currently in Washington. We know there's been discussion about the science of climate change, and those words actually often get taken out of documents. And I think when we move an agency like the CDC to a point where they have to be concerned about using words that are based in science, based in evidence, then we have politics reaching into science, and we won't have agencies that can do the best possible work that they can do. It has to obviously work in the current political climate, but it should be really absolute in its use of best practice and best science.
Dr. Remington, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Dr. Patrick Remington, Associate Dean in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us to talk about a report that leadership or some in the CDC are trying to avoid a certain words. We heard the list of seven words earlier in budget documents. Now we look back at some of the year's biggest science stories. Last week we dug into one of Discover Magazine's top 10 about a rewrite of the human evolution timeline. Now we'll check out some of the other big stories, including one that may have eclipsed the rest. Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover Magazine, and Bill Andrews is a senior associate editor at Discover. They're both based in Waushaw. Gemma, welcome back to the show.
Always great to be with you.
And Bill, good to have you with us.
Thanks. You too.
Well, I spoiled it a little bit there. Your number one story for the year, for a variety of reasons, was the big solar eclipse on August 21st. Bill, how did that make it to the top of the list?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was a little bit controversial in our offices this year because it isn't kind of a big finding. It isn't something new that science uncovered this year, which is usually what we try to recognize with our number one spot. But after debating everything and looking at all the things that did happen this year, we ended up picking it just because it was such a big event. We'd been planning on some kind of eclipse coverage and having people out in the field and witnessing it for themselves for literally for years. This is such a big event, and I think over 200 million American adults ended up seeing this eclipse, this uniquely American eclipse that no other country got to see totality, so it felt like a nice, you know, America kind of, yeah, national pride with this eclipse. So it was just everywhere, all over the summer. Everything was leading up to this big eclipse in August. So we just felt like, yes, a moment where everyone could agree this is cool. And with all the other kind of bitterness, and it's been a tough year in a lot of ways, at least this was something that for a few minutes everyone agreed was really neat. They could just look up and see something, or look online and see the whole show. And that's very rarely going to happen for something science-related. So we felt that was just so great.
And Bill, do you think that's something that stimulated people to be interested in the sun, the moon, and the stars, for that matter, outside of the eclipse day?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, maybe I'm just deluding myself because we want to believe that. But I feel like it got people really kind of curious about, well, you know, what is going on? Why does the why is the sun going to kind of blot out for a little bit? What's happening? And the eclipse glasses, people were always excited to learn that, hey, you can use those anytime you want. Just put them on, and if they're the real safety eclipse glasses, you can just look at the sun and look at the sunspots, see how they move as the sun itself revolves any day of the year. And so people were, oh, yeah, no, that's cool. I think I will try that. So at least in my personal experience, I think it did stimulate some more. I think I will look into this whole space situation.
I still have my eclipse glasses sitting on my desk. We watched them here at our studio. I imagine you watched them over in Waukesha if you couldn't make the trip too, right?
Right. A lot of my coworkers, there was an event in the parking lot to make sure that whatever there was to see through the clouds and everything that day, that they would be seen. Although I did get to go out and see totality from out in Tennessee, as a bunch of my other colleagues also got to go out and see totality from all across the country. So even if you couldn't see the big show itself, it was still kind of a nice communal activity that a lot of people could get together and enjoy the sky.
And Gemma, I want to bring you in on one of the other stories in your top 100 list. This was not right up there in the sky in front of us, but still interesting. A tick fossilized in amber that has some really old blood in it. Tell us about this story. This is weird.
Yeah, well, this is it's super cool. It's not weird. It's awesome.
Awesome, Gemma.
They have found the oldest mammalian red blood cells ever discovered, and they found them inside a tick that was encased in amber. Obviously, you know, it was resin back in the day, and then over time it became amber. But yeah, this tick was encased in it, and they actually found legitimate red blood cells still inside the tick. And they think what happened was a primate was grooming another primate, found the tick, and just, you know, picked it off and flicked it, and it landed in the tree resin. So the really cool thing is they think this, it's at least 15 million years old. It could be as old as 45 million years. And there's an update since we put this story in the magazine. It's pretty exciting. They have even more recently found a 99-million-year-old piece of amber with an engorged tick inside of it. And another tick found in a related piece of amber, so just as old, 99 million years old, was holding on to a dinosaur feather. And what's cool about this is we're finding these ticks that are older and older and older, whether it be the one with red blood cells like we found or scientists found earlier in the year, or this other more recent find with the 99-million-year-old ticks. And the great thing is we don't know that much about ticks, exactly when they evolved. So we are actually seeing researchers build the tick family tree further back in time. And, you know, I know, nobody likes ticks. They're gross. But it is really cool science happening right now.
Right. So we, apart from learning that ticks were a nuisance 15 million and 99 million years ago, can we take this blood and learn something about that and about the primates, I guess, that this tick was bothering?
Yeah. You know, not so much with the dinosaur material, the ticks that were preying on dinosaurs. And that's just because of a number of factors in the preservation of the amber itself. But with this other find, the 15 to 45 million year old find, where they have confirmed there are mammalian red blood cells in there. I mean, they already know they're from a mammal, and that's by the shape of the blood cell. So they're hoping to do further research and really figure out a way to look inside those cells in a way that's not destructive. Unfortunately, a lot of the methods that researchers use to really get inside these kinds of specimens, it destroys them, and obviously you don't want to destroy it. So they're kind of nosing around, trying different things, seeing what they can see without actually destroying the specimen.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak and Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine. They're based in Waukesha, and we're looking at some of the big news in science, technology, and math from 2017. And Bill, the field of mathematics doesn't always enter the field of politics. This year it did. It's relevant to Wisconsin. What kind of mathematical procedures are we talking about here?
Right. And this is an extra fun one because a lot of people think math, oh, I'll never use that in the real world. It's just a bunch of people with their head in the clouds. But this story actually shows that it can have real world consequences for everybody. And so what happened was basically, in a nutshell, mathematicians came up with a formula to determine if gerrymandering has occurred in terms of drawing unfair district lines in determining government representation. And so right there, I mean, after ticks, probably people hate politics even more, talking about politicians. But
can't say politic without tick.
Yes, that's exactly right. So this is one of those things that mathematicians had to get their hands dirty a little bit and work with the real world. But by altering the very minute levels, including an extra street or an extra house or an extra neighborhood here, they would the formula works by running simulations of votes and tweaking these district lines just a little bit. And if things were fair to begin with, those little tweaks shouldn't really make a big difference. But if they find that tweaking, making those little tweaks actually does result in different results for the elections, you know something was up at the very beginning. So this is something that can apply to a current court case with Pennsylvania, I believe, but I know Wisconsin also has some skin in the game when it comes to redistricting and possible gerrymandering. So now that there's an actual unbiased, scientific, mathematical way to highlight this, hopefully it'll be a way, it'll clear a path going forward and help the courts determine if this has actually happened or not.
Gemma, I want to turn to another. There's a lot we can get to. We won't get to it all. I want to go to Antarctica now, Gemma.
So do I.
And you've been there.
Really?
I haven't. You've been to Antarctica, right?
Yes, sir.
So the new news here is when we think of Antarctica, if we sang a song about it, we think we'd be singing about ice, but it turns out would be a song of ice and fire. There are a lot of volcanoes under Antarctica, we're learning.
Yes, yes. And, you know, we knew that there were volcanoes under Antarctica. In fact, when I lived there for 22 months, I was living on the island where we have Mount Erebus. And that is actually the southernmost active volcano in the world. So we knew there were volcanoes there, but what I love about this story is we're still finding out things about our planet that we thought we knew, but it turns out, actually, they have found more than 90 brand new, previously unidentified volcanoes in the West Antarctic Rift System. And that's basically an area where plate tectonics are just ripping the continent apart. It's kind of similar what's happening in Iceland. You know, the European plate and the North American plate are pulling apart, and that's why Iceland has a lot of volcanoes. Well, the same thing is going on in Antarctica. We had no idea just how many volcanoes were there. So 91 previously unidentified volcanoes. And the big question is, you know, the ice sheets in Antarctica are thinning due to climate change. And the question is, how will the volcanoes affect the thinning of the ice sheets, and how will the thinning of the ice sheets affect the volcanoes? Bringing up Iceland again, there's evidence that as the ice sheets in Iceland thin during the Middle Ages, there was a definite uptick in volcanic activity. So the question is, are we going to see that same thing happen in Antarctica, and how will that affect these huge ice sheets that right now are covering all these volcanoes we had no idea were there?
And that could be kind of a feedback loop. Less ice, if there are more volcanic eruptions there, that could further change the climate, right?
Yes, yeah. It has a lot of implications, and it's one of those things that scientists, you know, we didn't even know the volcanoes were there. So now that they know that they're there, they are launching studies on a number of fronts to really try to understand what's happening and what the consequences may be.
We're looking back at some of the biggest science stories of 2017 with Gemma Tarlak and Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think was the top science story of the year? What have you been following, big or small, when it comes to stories from the worlds of science, technology, math? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our discussion now about the top science news of 2017 with Gemma Tarlak and Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think was the most important, interesting, or just plain cool science news from the last year? What was the biggest discovery? Call in with your suggestions now at 800-642-1234. Or if you've been involved in citizen science or research yourself, you can let us know that too. 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Something I want to talk to you both about. Let's start with you, Bill. The Cassini probe in the Saturn area, the Saturn neighborhood, told us a lot. What were some of the big discoveries there?
Oh, I mean, almost everything that we currently know about Saturn and its moons, we learned from the Cassini mission. It left Earth about two decades ago, and just this year finally had to call it quits. Took a final swan dive into the atmosphere of Saturn itself, purely so that it wouldn't possibly contaminate some of the moons around Saturn, which we've since learned might actually be havens for life. I think that might be one of the more fascinating, interesting things that Cassini showed us, just how rife with possibility the solar system, and particularly Saturn's neck of the woods, is.
Yeah, Bill, what were the signs we saw on some of Saturn's moons that said, hey, you know, we obviously don't have the life itself, but there are conditions there that might work?
Right. In astronomy, all the scientists are always careful to say, no, we didn't see life, but signs consistent with a possibly habitable environment, which basically that's as close as we can come at this point. And in particular, the moon Enceladus was one of the most exciting finds for this, because astronomers knew that it existed. They knew it was small, relatively small and icy, like a lot of Saturn's moons. But after Cassini got there, we learned a lot more about this place, even colder than Antarctica. So one of the few places I think I know of that Gemma hasn't traveled to in her life.
Yet.
Yet, exactly. We don't know for sure, because Enceladus is so enticing. So it's got this icy crust, and beneath it, a global ocean over the whole moon, astronomers think. And for years, they've seen plumes of water shooting out of parts of the crust where there were openings. There were these beautiful-looking tiger stripes, is what the astronomers called them, where the crust was a little weaker, and you could see some of the insides of the planet, of the moon, excuse me, kind of slosh out. And over the years, Cassini was able to go through some of those plumes, actually taste the waters of this moon Enceladus, and it found that not only is it actual water, which you never know, it looked like water, but it found, yes, it's actual water. It's got organic compounds within it, and there's a chemical brew inside it that is similar to the kind that on Earth the bacteria at hydrothermal vents eat. So the conditions in Enceladus, it's got water, it's got a source of energy in Saturn right nearby, and ultimately the sun, and it's got the materials that could possibly lend some kind of life existence. So until we have a better view of this place, it looks like, yeah, I mean, all the check marks are checked off. Maybe life could actually exist there.
And Gemma, with this story and those Antarctic volcanoes, I think definitely I've thought a lot of times, oh, all the cool science is done. We're just kind of picking up the details. And clearly that's wrong. We're still finding new stuff all the time.
Absolutely, and that's actually one of the favorite things about my job, is that I get to watch this happen, and it's just, you know, sometimes it's really spine-tingling.
In a good way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak and Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the big stories in the world of science. We'll go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Richard is with us in Cambridge. Richard, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What's your big story for 2017?
Well, it's the saddest story I can think of, and it's the complete denial of science by the United States, by, of course, our leader, and then apparently everybody, at least on one side of the aisle, seems to support what they know is untrue.
And any particular parts of science you're concerned about?
Well, let's talk about the most obvious one that they're most vocal about, and that's climate science.
Gotcha. Richard, thanks for the call. And Gemma, there were climate change-related stories in your top 100, and you also talk about, and we talked about this last week a little bit, concerns about science and scientific research in 2017. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is really an unprecedented year in terms of the new administration coming in and refocusing their science goals and science aims, and also, in some cases, going directly against the recommendations of scientists, not just on climate change, that was obviously a huge, huge factor, but things like banning certain pesticides that we know are carcinogenic, and that a total ban was about to be enacted, and it was decided by this administration to put that on hold. And there are a number of other instances as well. Again, in a number of fields, there were recommendations for a particular species to be listed as endangered and given the protections that that entails. And again, this was a recommendation from the agency's own scientists, and it was decided not to protect that species. So we have a timeline, and Richard, I don't know if you're still on the line. I hope you are, and I hope you pick up the magazine and check out our number four story this year, because we felt it was very important to keep our readers informed on all these changes. And I want to say not all the changes have been negative. In fact, it's been really heartening to see a lot of scientists really embracing this opportunity to make their voices heard, to speak publicly, to run for office. We've seen a lot of citizens, ordinary citizens. You know, there were a million people out around the world in April for the March for Science, about 100,000 of them in Washington, D.C., people coming out and making their pro-science voices heard. And that, to me, was hugely heartening. So we do have a timeline. We will be putting an extended version online soon, but right now in our magazine, in our print magazine, we do have a timeline outlining a number of the really unprecedented changes that directly affect science policy and future research.
Richard, thanks a lot for that call. I want to get to another story or two in your top 100. Bill, let's check out, let's go further away than Saturn now. A star system with seven Earth-ish sized planets in it. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is in the field of exoplanets, as they say, worlds beyond our solar system. And we've been finding a few here or there the last few years, and it's always kind of neat, and we're getting closer to finding what I think is the true end goal for a lot of people, an actual Earth analog, where it's a planet that resembles Earth enough that we could imagine life as we know it being there. And so this year we made a pretty big step towards that in the sense of this system called the TRAPPIST-1 system that has seven, like you said, seven Earth-ish-sized worlds, which is the most we've ever found at once before. Only three of them are in the habitable zone where liquid surface water might exist, but even so, that's three already. And even more enticing and tantalizing about these, they all orbit very close to one another, some closer than Earth is to the Moon. So there's an idea in astronomy of panspermia where maybe a comet strikes a planet that has life on it, and then some of the detritus ejected from that planet, some of the rocks thrown off, has bacteria or other life on it, and then that can act as a seed for other worlds. And it actually, papers have come out saying that's completely plausible here in this TRAPPIST-1 system. Among some of these worlds, they're so close together. So definitely a site that astronomers will be keeping an eye on in the future.
Well, we got through a lot of your list, Gemma. Very briefly, just 20 seconds or so, some promising cancer research.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. So the FDA has finally approved CAR-T therapy. I should say CAR-T therapy has finally arrived. This is such a new and very important, very promising direction in ways to knock cancer down for good. And the great thing is this first drug is going to help a lot of children and young adults. So I can explain how it works, but not in 20 seconds, buddy. What are you going to do?
Gemma, I will thank you for joining us and look forward to talking to you again is what I'll do. Thanks, Gemma.
Thank you.
And Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, too.
We've been talking to Bill Andrews and Gemma Tarlak. They're both with Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, looking at some of the top stories in the year in science. Hasn't been a super snowy year so far, but there are parts of Wisconsin that have enough snow to go sledding. Volume 1 magazine in Eau Claire opened up a sledding debate with this question online. Is there an accepted tradition that you sled down the middle of the hill and then walk back up the side of the hill? I assumed everyone would say walk back up the side until I talked to producer Halima Shah. Hey, Halima.
Hey, Rob.
You have your own method.
I do. As a creature of habit, what I'm inclined to do is to do exactly what I did in reverse. So when I get to the bottom of the hill, I just turn around and go back up.
Uh-huh. Like right back up the path you just sledded.
So the thing is, I slided.
Yeah,
down.
Sure.
So, I mean, I know that there are, like, let's say there are two lanes of traffic. I just go up through the space in the middle.
And you've never been run over doing this?
No, but maybe near I'm a misses? Bit of an adrenaline junkie.
Yeah, I mean, because this seems hazardous, and I've been going down hills and seen the people walking up, and it's hard to steer most form of sled craft, as I call them.
It is, but I mean, if you have two eyes and if you're quick, you can do it.
And nobody's had to bail. Wait, maybe you're just oblivious to the people bailing out before they crash into you.
This might be true, but I have a great time either way.
Now, it's been some years since I've been sledding. When my kids were littler, we did it a lot more. Do you, again, given the presence of snow, do you get out and try to sled in the winter?
I haven't done it in a long time. I will say that I almost got hurt the last time I did it.
Well, the sledding world may be safer for your absence. Liam, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
More coming up here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.